Hello, hello, everyone. I'm your host, the most pleasant ghost, the Prim Reaper. And here tonight with me, I have the lovely and intelligent Anna Cherry. And we're just going to go ahead and jump right into it. No intro, because we are reading a few of the stories that a few of you have sent to us over email. Thank you very much for doing that, by the way. Anna, how are you tonight?
Doing quite good. Ready to hear this story time, dive into the topic.
Yeah, we'll just curl up by the fire and get nice and warm. I don't know how it is where you are, but we got quite a snow dump before, so.
Well, we got air conditioning on, but it is it is November almost in California, so you know how it goes.
Not fair. But anyway, we'll go ahead and get started so that we're not wasting everybody's time. All right, so we have three letters tonight. But I've gone ahead and I've made them all mostly anonymous, changed the names, that kind of thing, just out of respect for the people sharing their stories. So without further ado, I'm going to go ahead and start reading the first one. Anna, if you want to say anything at any point during the letters, by all means, go ahead and feel free to
interrupt. Got it. Yeah, will do.
Okay, so this first one came from Jay. Hey gang, just a behind-the-scenes badger here who was very moved by your recent men's mental health show this past weekend. Little old, as you can tell. I mentioned this before some time ago to Hannah with my individuality Twitter feed before I became involved with you, but never went into detail. Given your recent on-air call for men's experiences in therapy, I would like to share my story of therapy, which I am still going through. I hope you don't judge me as harshly as I have judged myself. I have the rare circumstance of having learned the behavior of sexual abuse from both the roles as a first survivor and then a perpetrator of abuse of a sexual nature before even reaching high school. While both incidents were isolated, their direct relation is undeniable. After beginning life after high school in post-secondary institutions, I found myself unable to cope with memories I had repressed, which had begun to surface. I fell into depression, self-destructive friendships and habits, and blew my post-secondary education not just once, but twice over a 10-year period. During this time, I frequently sought help from the channels available as they slowly evolved in the 21st century, only to find as time went on and I was no longer student age, that I was now considered too privileged by some to even be offered the help I needed to cope. It was only through learning to self-reflect and ask the tough questions I could even begin to find stability, which wasn't until I was 30. Somehow, I had survived my 20s, but at the cost of friendships I had kept close most of my life. Attachments are indeed potentially toxic sometimes. When I finally refused to take no for an answer from the system, I spent the second half of my 20s being offered nothing more than welfare and addiction support to treat the symptom of my mental health issue. Eventually, I was faced with the reality I was going to die at the hands of this problem manifesting in my life, or I needed to help myself because nobody else seemed to care. Thankfully, I decided I cared. In late 2009, got onto a waiting list for a support worker as the mental health entities in Canada began to umbrella and merge late into the tween era of 2005 to 2013, but sadly, I didn't get much further for over 2 years. In 2011, I was finally offered a worker who went on maternity leave just 6 months into my support, and there were issues with assigning a new worker, so I fell through the cracks again to lose all support I had waited years on lists for. All the while, this is while surviving off a welfare income as a man in his 30s, in a city where most of the rental property is geared towards university students and women, making it especially difficult during these years to keep a roof over my own head, in spite of always being on time with rent for almost 10 years consistently, for longer than 18 months at a time. Thankfully, in 2013, I finally got some real support through a local counseling center which took me in under a new program geared towards men who were survivors of abuse early in life, a program which, sadly, got pulled off the shelves for a while before being reinstated again in 2015. During those years, I met a counselor who pulled a ton of strings after getting to know me to continue seeing me when the program was off the shelves so I wouldn't have my therapy disrupted. She was trained in EMDR and confided in me that she was indeed not a feminist, and that she was discouraged that the mental health industry clearly had been shifting away from men entirely, even then, 5 years ago. That counselor has since moved away with a better job, but the institution remains with their program for men. The question I ask, and nobody can answer, is how long until it loses funding? I don't know, but I know one thing. Even if the institutions as a whole won't or can't help, never decide it's better not to seek help. Do not buy into the mentality that you are not worth it because blank. Every counselor and support worker is a human being on a one-to-one level, and so are you. Never underestimate the power of humanity. My current therapist is a feminist, and while I don't see her that way any longer because she doesn't act like most of the man-hating cult, and I suspect her age and maturity to have something to do with that, we took time to build trust, and the point I want to make is that even if you do encounter some haters on your road to recovery, disclaimer, you almost certainly will. Even if they call themselves feminist, remember that some feminists can still be red-pilled. You owe it to yourself to seek help, and you need to be the first person to decide that, even if the first 9 out of 10 times you are turned away or discouraged from doing so. Never give up your struggle. It is our struggles in this life that turn us into great overthrowers of those who seek to oppress. Most sincerely, Baby Badger J.
Aw, thank you for your volunteer work, first of all.
Yeah, absolutely.
Those are definitely the badgers that keep the... that are running in the wheel that keep the machine going. But I do have a question about the judgment things that you mentioned. Hopefully won't judge as harsh as he's judged himself, and I'm not sure what that refers to specifically. I'm assuming that can't possibly refer to the original assault, since that's obviously in no way his fault. Or is it about the years wasted, essentially, in his own words, on struggling with something before deciding to take action? Because, and even that, obviously not your fault. Circumstances conspired in the way that they did. And yeah, there's definitely a personal responsibility element of deciding to proactively go after bettering yourself. And I personally would, and do, suffer from self-judgment on the time that I've allowed to lapse before changing, you know, my strategy and actually going actively after something instead of, like, just, you know, blaming everything around me. So I can understand that being self-judgment, but I just wish that was a little clearer as to what he means by that.
I think what he meant, like, he referred at the beginning that he was both a survivor and a perpetrator of abuse of a sexual nature, so...
Was it perpetrator? That confused me. If you could reread that paragraph, sentence, because I wasn't sure what happened there.
I have the rare circumstance of having learned the behavior of sexual abuse from both the roles as a first survivor and then a perpetrator of abuse of a sexual nature before even reaching high school.
I see. So there's, okay, so if I were to guess, which I probably shouldn't, but as any therapist knows, you probably shouldn't guesstimate around these things, but based on the verbiage and the before high school thing and perpetrative sexual assault, I'm assuming it involved underage touching. I hate the word molestation. It's so, like, scary. Because sometimes, you know, as I've been controversial in pointing out, based on my own personal experiences, children under the age of 18 or even under the age of 15 explore sexuality, and they actively, boys and girls, believe it or not, girls actively seek out sexual attention before the age of 15. Believe it or fucking not, it happens. So I know it's so controversial for me to say, and people might be coming after me again in the Twitters or wherever's and asking my opinion on Muhammad's brides, but, you know, like, no, children do have sexual feelings. So if I were to guess, he might mean that, like, a perpetrator of sexual assault before high school, because, you know, it's, like, illegal and bad to touch kids, even though it might have been consensual at the time, whatever, who cares, doesn't matter. It's bad and wrong and terrible, and so he probably is referring to something like that, in which case, I personally don't think you should really judge yourself about that. But on the other hand, if it was, like, all forced and fucked up and not in play, then, ew, no, not cool. Not cool at all, but there's just a frustrating conflation between illegal, therefore gross and immoral stuff versus consensual stuff that happens to be legal, like underage play. So it's, I don't know, it's annoying to me that that gets conflated, because
yeah,
one
absolutely.
Is genuine exploration and the other one is, you know, predatory behavior and that is not happy and fun. And there's a huge difference between them to me. But
oh, absolutely. And of course, I mean, you know, when people do face that kind of abuse as children, it unfortunately, like a lot of the times, it just does mess up their ability to develop those kinds of urges in a healthy way. So, I mean, like, there's that to be considered as well. And I mean, it sounds like, just from the way this letter was written, that you know, Jay, you've done a lot of things to try and improve yourself and work on yourself and get past the traumas that you suffered. So, you know, while I understand judging yourself for having done those behaviors, like it does sound like you're legitimately working to get past that, right? So I don't judge you. I think that you went through some terrible things, and I think that you're trying to fix it. So, you know, you should be glad for that.
And of course, on the other hand, on top of that, it is a unique position or perspective to find oneself in. So there could at least be an element of thankfulness for, you know, the outcome of your situation, not so much for it happening, but at least now in the end, you have the unique perspective, as you mentioned, of knowing the issue or feeling the issue from both sides of the spectrum, as both a victim and a victimizer, and how easily those two are melded into one. And to me, that always lends to empathy and pity for people who are predators or perpetrators, or, you know, angry or in some way toxic, which of course there are people who are toxic for different reasons, but generally we see the male spectrum being quote unquote toxic or dysfunctional because of the pain that they had to endure. And so that pain got transformed into anger, and, you know, that therefore some other thing, it became some other thing, but initially it's, you know, it comes from pain. And I just, I don't know, I have a lot of empathy for that.
Yeah, absolutely. And I mean, you know, people will develop negatively in different ways after dealing with sexual trauma as well, too. So, I mean, like, that's, you know, like it's not an excuse to engage in abusive behaviors. Like, I can understand where that comes from and where that would have come up. So, again, it's complicated, and it can be tough. It can be tough enough to get past it without overly judging yourself. I just think that it's good that you're working to move past it. So that's fantastic, in my opinion. Now, another thing that I wanted to point out here was closer to the end of the letter. Just let me get back here again. Yeah, it was basically just how some of the therapists that you had seen were feminists and were not feminists. And I kind of wanted to take this opportunity to sort of clarify something, just because I'd actually had somebody reach out to me with the last video that I made that was talking about finding a counselor that's right for you. And they're like, you know, that could, not all feminist therapists are going to be like that. And it's like, well,
I was just about to say that I hate that we have to make that as a distinction. As you were saying, you know, speaking of feminist versus non-feminist therapists, I hate that we even have to bring that up, that it is a difference even in between those two.
Exactly. Like, you're going to find crazy people who identify as feminists, and then you're going to find sane people who identify as feminists. And it's not just a blanket term that we can throw out that's like, oh my gosh, always guaranteed avoid this thing, right? Like, there are the people, like Christina Hoff Sommers is always a really good example, who identify as feminists but are very sympathetic to men's issues. The last video that I had put out was basically just, you know, for those who are wanting to play it safe and avoid that kind of thing, because, I mean, let's be real here. It's an ideology that a lot of us on Honey Badger Radio are none too fond of, to say the least. But that doesn't mean that everybody who identifies with that label is necessarily going to be a man-hater. So, you know, I'm glad that you mentioned here in this letter that, you know, it's not necessarily about whether that person is a feminist or not. It's about what they will do to help you get through your difficulties. And I'm glad that this person that you're seeing is somebody who is legitimately working to help you through those troubles. So I'm all in favor of that. So, did you have anything else that you wanted to add for this one?
I think we covered all the bases.
All right. Well, then, in that case, I will go ahead and start reading the second letter. The next letter comes from H, so I'm just going to get right into it. As per Prim's request, I'm a single man, late 20s, been in and out of therapy throughout most of my adult life. Most of my experience has been with male counselors, mostly in the US and some in Canada. I've been fortunate to have avoided the feminist therapeutic perspective, though the first therapist I spoke to after splitting from my abusive ex seemed completely disinterested in her actions and preferred to justify the situation by positing that she and I had both made mistakes. Didn't stick with him for very long. Almost all of the therapy that I received in the US focused on my lack of skill in boundary setting. Very helpful skill to have and useful for future prevention of the experiences that landed me in therapy in the first place. Excuse me, but not terribly helpful for dealing with the emotional quagmire that remained. I studied in Vancouver for my master's, and after a year of chronic near-suicidal depression, therapy seemed like a good idea. Therapy through my school was free, but the need among the student body so drastically exceeded the personnel available to them, the typical student would be able to talk to a therapist for perhaps half an hour a month. Ironically, I was able to meet with a female therapist, the only woman I have ever sought out, who is one of the kindest people I've ever met with, and has zero interest in feminist therapeutic theory. What she helped me to work on involved emotional self-awareness and grief techniques. If I understand her correctly, and if her perspective is in fact accurate, the issue of chronic depression is solved neither by stoicism, male silence, nor by talking it out with someone, feminist theory. Instead, chronic depression is addressed through the awareness of our various emotional states, a willingness to acknowledge them, allowing them to play out as our psyche has need, and, having identified the emotion and cause, to take steps to reduce or limit the cause. If that's the case, then coping when you feel like shit has little to do with how much or how little you talk about it, but with possessing mature skills to live with the emotions that we have. Apparently, 2 + 2 = voodoo doll. On a related note, I had a number of very interesting conversations online in the wake of #MeToo, which reflected in some very interesting ways on how the academic community, including therapists, deals with male depression. I made the mistake of trying to advocate against beginning a male witch hunt in the hopes that people would care more about addressing the suffering caused by sexual abuse and assault, wherever it happens to show up, than trashing men on a global scale. Whoops. In both of the two conversations I had, I presented my argument against demonizing men on the basis that I'm a man who has experienced a fair amount of sexual harassment and relational abuse, all perpetuated by women. Thus, I don't see the issue of sexual misconduct as gendered. In the first conversation, I was engaged in an academic conversation in which a number of women were advocating typical misandry. I can't remember their words exactly, but they were unsurprised by the breaking of #MeToo and were into the usual toxic masculinity patriarchy BS. When I brought up my own story, the tone of the conversation did a stereotypical feminist 180, and instead of, "Oh crap, I guess this issue isn't just a matter of men abusing women, maybe we ought to tone it down a bit," what I got was, "Oh god, we're so sorry, that's awful, are you serious? What do you want me to do with the 5 comments right above mine, then? How the blazes do you expect me to take your sympathy seriously here? Dishonesty really vexes me." In the second, the immediate response that I received from the woman in question was attack. She was speaking in a way that betrayed a great deal of bitterness and anger, and I tried to give a little pushback towards a stance of general compassion, again on the basis of my past experience. She questioned the authenticity of my claims about having been harassed and criticized me for being insensitive towards real abuse victims. A number of people jumped on the bandwagon in support of my concerns, as unexpected She didn't really budge, and eventually fell into the stance of explaining that the only solution involves men learning how to talk about their feelings. What I found particularly odd is that this particular woman, who I've interacted with before and who is more than a bit of a firecracker, is herself a licensed therapist. Suffice it to say that I don't recommend her to anyone living in Washington State. Lastly, the status that I posted to my Facebook at the time effectively offered sympathy to anyone who had lived through sexual mistreatment, but encouraged a level-headed compassion and asked people to avoid the witch hunt mentality. The majority of the response I got was angry people complaining that my post was insensitive to women. The irony speaks for itself. Essentially, it seems that feminists have one of two possible reactions to men in pain: false sympathy or criticism. Certainly never an attempt to understand men's perspectives or needs. I'm lucky that I've had the opportunities for therapy that I needed when I had need of them, and I'm incredibly grateful for that. However, I'm particularly worried by the difficulty that other men I know have had in finding real help for their pain in the midst of a society that seems to be increasingly gifted at inflicting pain on them. I think it's particularly ironic how often I find myself spending time with highly gifted intellectuals who have been incels for years, because friendly, well-meaning, confident, and highly trained and intelligent men are apparently a complete turn-off for the average woman. Suffice it to say that most of the middle-aged women I've talked to are very confused by their successors. And that's the end of it there. All right.
That was a whole lot of stuff.
yeah. There's definitely a lot to go through.
Span the gamut of all types of things.
Yeah.
I might have to break them up a little to give us more of a chance to respond. Especially the next one. The next one is quite long. But not to jump the gun here. I think... it's, first of all, like, it's sad, the experiences that you've had with people basically dismissing your feelings and dismissing what you've been through. I don't necessarily think, on the one hand, that it's always going to be false sympathy from people, but on the other hand, when they're in one breath talking about how, you know, the patriarchy is evil and men are monsters and blah blah blah, yeah, it's gonna be mighty tough to take any sympathy from that seriously as soon as you start saying, well, but I'm a guy and I have, you know, I've experienced abuse myself, so there you go.
Yeah, there's definitely that's the interesting thing, is people don't really think about, going back to the beginning of the letter, it's not the same reaction you get when you, as a man, say, I am a victim of emotional or even physical abuse by a partner. And you don't mean a man, you mean a woman. There's really just sort of a lukewarm, lackluster kind of response to that. People don't seem to really care. And on one hand, it's like, yeah, men are bigger and stronger than women. They can probably take, like, essentially, if you think, you know, like, you have thicker skin, physically, literally, let's say, and, like, you can actually, you know, female attacks are like little mosquito bites bouncing off of you, and, you know, going back to, like, sort of 50s-esque cartoon type of, you know, things where it's like a woman's being rough, and then you just, like, roughly shake her up or give her a quick bitch slap, and you're like, calm yourself, woman! You know, so, like, theoretically, you know, physical attacks or something like that shouldn't really hurt or matter. It's just a woman flipping out and being weird. But that's sort of an outdated view, and I'm sure women are not happy about that. The same kind of women that, you know, did not give favorable responses to Star Trek, a series having a female captain. The same kinds of women, they probably are not very happy, and these are the women around us. They're also probably not very happy about the feminization of mankind, and something that they are actively pushing, even though they don't realize that the two things are connected, that the men around them are not as strong or big or emotionally tough, let's say. And I mean that in not specifically about sort of their own emotions, but that too. But, you know, traditionally, women need a stabilizing force in their lives. And traditionally, the genders have worked in a harmony that allows for a stable presence, which is a male, and sort of a chaotic, all over the place presence that is female, and they complement each other, but also, you know, need each other. And the more men become feminized, the less of this sort of rock or stabilizing force that women have, the more they wig out, the more they affect men, the more men become feminized, and it's just a big fucking mess at this point. But women are resentful of the fact that men are not so immovable anymore. And in fact, I would advocate, most of the time, it's, of course, it's a joke, you know, how do you know when a woman's lying? Well, her lips are moving. It's sort of, I would say that for normie, for NPCs, essentially, in general, when a lot of times women believe things that they sort of like cerebrally, that they've, the ideas that they've heard, but they don't really match up with the reality necessarily. So they will repeat things like, oh yeah, I want a man who's sensitive, and I want this kind of cuck, this kind of man and that kind of man. And they will repeat certain things, but then, of course, as we know, and incels will tell us, in reality, they go after a very, very, very different man than they say they want. So why is that? Like, why does that happen? Well, a lot of times women are not very self-aware in terms of what their true desires are. They either don't let themselves experience it or are somehow blocked off from experiencing it, but one way or another, they don't really, they're not as in touch with what they sexually want or otherwise. And so a lot of times you shouldn't really pay attention to what women are saying, and they will say certain things like, you know, I want a man who's sensitive, I want him to be in touch with his feelings and this and that, but then of course they don't reward men for being sensitive or in touch with their feelings. In fact, they reject them, and what they want is a man who will not care about their feelings, because yeah, that could be like one of those callous, abusive asshole boyfriend things. Like, well, why do they like that? Why did they go for that? Well, a lot of times that also means that he won't be with her in every single up and down, and every sort of feeling weird every 2 seconds. The guy will like match the woman in the constant emotional flip outs. Like, no, can't fucking have that. Need a man who will frame control something that is calm and chill, and that's why women gravitate towards strong men. So on one hand, you know, it's unfortunate that that is sort of the role of men, but on the other hand, when their sexes are in harmony, men can be more, I don't know what the word to use, but men can let things bounce off of them more because they're not constantly under fucking attack. And they can not be as affected by, you know, what would be deemed as abuse or, you know, unwanted this or that. Like, people could shrug it off more if we weren't constantly attacking men. And men could be the stabilizing force that women need if we weren't constantly attacking men. But as it stands, you know, we still have certain expectations of men that are outdated because we have been feminizing and exponentially speeding up the weird civilizing effect on us as genders, as males, as females, as just primates. We've been changing the way men are under constantly attacking them, as we know, social defeat stress does lower testosterone, and men's testosterone levels at record lows. And then we have phytoestrogens and a variety of hormonal estrogens and things like that that we get from phytoestrogens come from soy, literally soy boy. Phytoestrogens do come from soy, and then we have phyto means plant estrogens, and then we have hormones coming from chicken and food like that, like meat. So from a variety of sources, and of course plastics, BPA, and whatever the fuck they've replaced it with now, the runoff is notoriously known to cause reproductive issues. And so we're just, in a variety of ways, are bombarding the sexes, particularly the male sex. And we are feminizing our species, I believe. And I haven't even read that book, The Feminization of Species, which is about fish, but it does draw parallel upon humanity. And I mean, I can see the ways in which we are becoming feminized through physical means, and then through emotional, psychological, I guess, rather, attack and assault on everyone through the media, by feminism, etc. So, you know, we have put men in this position where we've radically escalated evolution away from the traditional, quote unquote, gender roles as determined by biology and by our primate beginnings. and we still have culture that relies on men to be men in the way that female instincts, female primates want and need, because we are still animals in our bodies, but then we have all this fucked up psychological shit that has, you know, risen just in the past 30 years because we're escalated that sort of aspect of the cultural evolution, and men are a fucking mess because we've made them that, but where are all the good men gone? Where happened to that? And so that's essentially a long-winded way of saying why we don't care about men being abused by women, because it's like, yeah, whatever, women are insane, they're going to be all over the place, they're going to abuse themselves, they're going to be self-destructive, they're going to abuse themselves, others, their kids, they're like the bad things, that women do bad things, they just fucking do, and they need a man. I'm sorry to sound fucking, I don't know, 50s misogynist up in here, I Love Lucy, but like, they need a man to grab them by the shoulders, and they need a daddy and be like, no, calm the fuck down, it's okay, just like swaddle them emotionally, and then they can harmoniously like coexist. Men have been kicked away from that position, and yet we still, you know, expect them to behave as if they have that position. The whole patriarchy thing, like, it hasn't been true ever, but even at times when it has been true that men were given this position of leadership, as they rightfully, I believe, should, that lasted for like 2 seconds before feminism took that over. So, but of course, I have my own theories for why that happened, and most of it has to do with spending habits. But you know, whatever.
Yeah, it's actually like a whole interesting perspective, and like a good discussion could definitely be had about like that entire subject, because
entire monologue.
Yeah. No, no, because I mean, like, I'm sure that the implication that women need men to sort of calm their tendencies would elicit just the most absurd, loud from everybody. But it's, you know, it doesn't necessarily. Gosh, how to phrase it? I'm having trouble tonight. But you know, you can't necessarily simplify it down to that. Sure, but like to say that women need men like a fish need a bicycle is just an obvious wrong thing to say. Because I think, you know, honestly, I think at our core, both sexes really balance out each other.
Well, we evolved coexisting and cohabiting and co-parenting, so there's, you know,
exactly,
there's some patterns we've adapted to for sure by now.
Yeah, exactly. And I mean, while I wouldn't go as far as to say like we need to have somebody of the opposite sex in our life, because like, you know, there are plenty of women and men who either live alone, you know, by choice, or you know, because they couldn't find somebody. And I don't want to go ahead and say, okay, well, these people are clearly missing out on a crucial aspect of humanity or anything like that. But, you know, at our core, we're a dimorphic species. We are a species that has evolved, like you just said, cohabitating, co-parenting. We complement each other in a variety of different ways. And I find, like, there's a whole bunch of research that says that people who are in long-term committed relationships, they can derive a lot of benefit from that, assuming, of course, the relationship is a harmonious one. But yeah, so, like, it's not necessarily as simple as saying we need each other, but it's also not as simple as saying, you know, we don't need each other. So it's kind of an interesting topic to be had, really. But there was another thing that I wanted to kind of touch on from this letter also, not to get too wrapped up in just the one subject, but it was basically nearer to the beginning where he said, if I understand her correctly and if her perspective is in fact accurate, the issue of chronic depression is solved neither by stoicism, male silence, nor by talking it out with someone, feminist theory. Instead, chronic depression is addressed through the awareness of our various emotional states, willingness to acknowledge them, allowing them to play out as our psyche has need, and having identified the emotion and cause, to take steps to reduce or limit the cause. I thought that was a really interesting point, and it's kind of one of those things that's a little bit tricky because there are a lot of different counseling models out there, and, you know, not always do they agree fully or get along. People will have different beliefs on what causes things, or, you know, what is the best path to dealing with them or whatever. But somebody in the comments just said, bad prim, stoicism is not silence. That was not me. That was the person who wrote the letter. So calm down. but yeah, so what I was saying is just that there's going to be different models of dealing with depression, depending on the counselor you're seeing, depending on the model of counseling that they run by, right? Because somebody who believes in, say, I don't know, Gestalt therapy is going to have a very different idea on that compared to somebody who practices Adlerian therapy or Freudian therapy or cognitive behavioral therapy, that kind of thing, right? It's not necessarily that one has the upper ground over the rest of them. I think it's basically a matter of accepting the fact that what's going to resonate with some people is not necessarily going to resonate with others. For example, there was another person in the live chat who was talking about how their counselor was using unconditional positive regard in therapy, and that's a Rogerian concept, but it's one that I happen to actually appreciate myself, like when somebody is talking that way with me, but they were saying that it was an infuriating thing for them, right? So it's not necessarily that the concept is bad. It's that it's not resonating with them, and sometimes that's going to happen. So when you have a therapist that you don't jive with, it might not necessarily be because the therapist is bad or because, you know, mental health practitioners in general are quacks or don't know what to do to help you out. It could just be that you're not fitting with that kind of therapy and that maybe you should try something else, or maybe you can even try something for yourself that's just different from what the therapist is doing. But, you know, kind of to go back to what the previous letter said, you should really acknowledge that sometimes getting help can be a useful thing, and that reaching out to somebody different, somebody who takes a different approach that might resonate with you better, might be a better path forward. So I don't know if you have anything to add on that subject, Anna.
I would if I could.
Okay.
I definitely don't. Don't think I'll be shy. I'll butt my way in if I feel the need.
All right. Okay. So let me just double check here. Yeah. I mean, as far as all of the Me Too stuff, like, I mean, I think that we've talked out that subject quite a lot on this channel. Like, obviously.
Oh, I have a point about that.
Okay.
Totally unrelated, directly anyway, but sort of related to the Me Too thing and men's mental health, and something that is my little corner of the world, as well as a bunch of other cam girls. It's affecting, I think, all of us. And yeah, it is a Me Too thing, but I think it especially ramped up after Kavanaugh. Could also be whatever weird oil price economy thing is happening with the whole Saudi Arabia thing right now too, though. But anyway, long story short, men are not buying. And I don't mean porn, but specifically actually cam girl interactions, because my website's doing great. But when it comes to, like, a bunch of cam girls are echoing the sentiment that guys are not engaging. And I mean, I see that too myself, especially in October, but people are sort of there, but they're not saying anything. So I think there's just been a whole massive scare that has affected, I don't know if scare is the right word, but like massive just stress that has affected men's mental health, therefore sexuality, and because the stress is related to the whole men's sexuality thing. And, you know, just talking to women could be construed as sexual harassment, as we saw with a bunch of actors like Henry Cavill, etc., come out after the Me Too scare and mention how, you know, they're essentially afraid to interact with women without, you know, 10,000 cameras on them, and, you know, 50 people and stenographers. paying attention to everything that's happening, to make sure they're not accused, because, you know, there's really no repercussions for false allegations. However, there's hella repercussions for just the allegation as a man. Between that and, of course, the actual, like, Kavanaugh and sexual activity and drinking and sex and women and all of that being one big mess. And, of course, social defeat, stress-lowering, testosterone, as I was mentioning earlier, and a variety of other ways in which could be the cold weather and things like that, of course, hurricanes, etc., disasters of that sort, but just in general, it feels like the mood has been, especially after Me Too, has really soured after the summer, where people are essentially literally scared to talk to girls and even cam girls. And I mean, it's not like a lot of them identify themselves as feminists, but at this point, it's sort of safe to assume that if they're a sex worker or a naked person of any kind, they're probably going to be a feminist, which is just weird, but that's like a weird thing that just happened in the industry. And there's, yeah, a lot of allegations of mistreatment in the sex industry, which is that's going to be my next video on my channel. So, yeah, there's a lot of stuff there that I think has affected men emotionally, because it's been quiet, really, really quiet. And a variety of websites are reporting this phenomenon, and I have personally experienced it too. And I'm on like one of the busiest ones, so I don't know what is happening, but I think guys are defeated, and it really fucking sucks. And it's kind of like one of those days of like, you know, women not showing up to work day. We're getting that as women now from dudes, and I think unfortunately it's hitting sex workers first, but I think we'll also be the first ones to bounce back. But essentially, women will eventually, I think pretty soon, see what the world is like without men, and they're not gonna like it. They're probably gonna abuse men some more for it to try to get it back. See, it's like I've personally experienced this too. It's a weird histrionic loop thing, or whatever it is where you, things don't go your way, and so you punish people to try to make things go your way, and then they don't go your way, and so you punish people to try to make things go your way. It's like if it doesn't work, apply more pressure, and if that doesn't work, apply more pressure. And it's like after a while, it's like, no, applying pressure is what the problem is in the first place. And you need to back the fuck off and make yourself open and inviting to men, instead of keep pressuring them, and then you'll actually get what you want. But it's hard, I guess, for people to wrap their heads around that. But that would almost be my advice too to mothers, because of course I'm seeing in the wake of Me Too all that mothers are feminist types that are mothers are talking about how, oh, you know, they have boys and they worry because, you know, they're going to be predators or what have you. And how do I talk to my son about not raping? And it's like, well, geez. Maybe if you are an open and loving and unconditionally loving mother who is there for your son, that would humanize women to him to an extent where, you know, he wouldn't even think of being callous or misogynistic or in some way distrustful or whatever towards a woman, because he has such a glowing example of feminine fucking warmth by his side, being his mother. That would be a great fucking way to start, to actually be something that's venerable instead of being a goddamn hag from a Disney movie that is, you know, essentially forcing, being the evil queen that is like, you know, everyone must obey me in the name of feminism, and it really fucking causes him to hate you and want to kill you with a sledgehammer, which sometimes apparently happens, according to Dr. Phil. But I mean, you never know if those things are real or not. But yeah, boys kill their mothers with sledgehammers because they're fucking evil cunts. Like, I see it happen all the time. Why are we not talking about abuse of men or boys even by their mothers? Oh, that's right, because nobody fucking cares when women abuse men, because it's so rampant and nobody points it out. We need an Anita Sarkeesian for that. Everything is sexist. Everything is misandrist.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah, There's a lot with that, and I could go on all of that for a long, long time, but in the interest of time, we do still have a whole long letter to get through here, and I'll have to move on to that, but yeah, definitely lots going on there, that's for sure. Before I wanted to move on to this last letter, I did just want to go through the super chats, just so that they're not building up too much. So the first one that we got was from Albert Nada, who gave us $5 Canadian. He said, "Want to let everyone know my new video, Media Bias and Male Victims, is uploading. It's 25 minutes long, so it will take a long time." There you go, Albert, your daily shill. All right. Octavio Bannock gave us $2, and I'm pretty sure that's rupees. I did go and look it up after the last talk when Hannah wasn't quite sure what that was. If I'm wrong, I'm sorry, but I'm just basing myself off of the expectation that that's what that is. So he gave us 2 rupees and said, "Absinthe is the always answer." All right, there we go. Safely can agree with that, except not right now for me. All right, Octavio Bannock also gave us 5 rupees and said, "Absinthe is greater than women, and traps is greater than women." Well, you know, different strokes for different folks.
What are traps greater than absinthe is the ultimate question.
There you go. There's the question. There's the million-dollar question. I don't know, because it's hard to say, because mathematically he didn't really give us enough to know for sure what absinthe and traps are, just that they're both technically greater than women. So, you know, maybe we'll figure it out one day. And last but not least, Barry Bluebird gave us $2 and said, "I am late. What did I miss?" Well, basically, so far...
A few rants here and there, a few monologues.
Yeah, so far we've gone through 2 of the 3 letters that we're going to be talking about today, so we're just about to move on to the 3rd letter, and this one is definitely longer. So, yeah, let's just get right into it. So I had to preface this one. This one is from C. "Thank you so much for sending us such a detailed account of your story. I am going to have to trim it down a little just in the interest of time tonight, but I'm going to try and keep in the important parts. So, dear Badgers, first, let me preface this with informing you that my story is so horrifying to me that when I think back on it, certain events make me physically throw up and cry even to this day. I do not know how much of this you would share because of it. Just be advised, it does not finish as it starts. The first birthday party I remember, I had to share it with someone else whose birthday it was not. In hindsight, I understand why it was done, but at the age of 4, it does not feel good, like you don't matter to your own family, and that birthdays can be moved to whenever it is convenient, so the day is also not important. You could call this the start of my withdrawal from being social from other people. C talks here a little bit more about his experiences of being more advanced than his classmates and this causing some problems with the other students. There's also a brief section here talking about the birth of his stepsister and the hiring of a nurse who treated her and him and his other siblings poorly. One day, I woke up with a sore leg and walked like a Charlie horse. The school thought that my stepfather, who was awesome, was abusing me. They sent me and my 2 older brothers in for counseling. The way I understood it was that the school thought that we were crazy, and so I resisted the way any 5-year-old would when told they were something they were not. Big mistake. I was declared ADHD and put on Ritalin because I resisted being called crazy and wouldn't tell them how evil my stepfather was. The bad brother was more than willing to play along with the counselors. My eldest brother was also declared depressed and put on antidepressants. What I did not know was that my mother was using our child support for her bar tab." So then he talks about a little about his real father and how he was stern but fair in discipline. He found out about my mother's bar crawling life and decided that because the court wouldn't do anything, he would give us kids the child support as proper clothes, winter boots, snowshoes, life jackets, fishing rods, and allowance directly. The social workers were given a new mission: find a way to go after our father. An opportunity presented itself when the bad brother claimed that our father had tied us behind the truck and made us run for one of our disciplines that the bad brother had started. Suddenly there was a child representative and my mother in the same room, convincing me that my father had in fact done this. My father was sent to jail for not paying my mother's bar tab, and an absolute lie. So I just want to kind of interject here. Like, that's obviously that's a really terrible thing that happened. I feel like it's a real shame that they would just automatically seek to go after your father like that. But at the same time, I feel like it's not entirely surprising that would happen. Just because of the fact that he was trying to give the child support in the form of things that you could actually use. My husband kind of talked about how his dad was sort of trying to do the same sorts of things, because he would often send a lot of money and, you know, their mother just would let them run around in falling apart runners and things like that. It's like, where is this money that I'm sending you going to? Really not okay.
It seems like there's maybe something else going on for a school to so actively go after a person. Like, there had to have been some sort of personal grudge or something he either is not disclosing or may not have been aware of because of being a child. But that just doesn't make sense to be so actively targeting a single man unless there's some sort of personal something, it seems like.
Yeah, no, I honestly don't know why they would have done that quite so hard, but anyway, I'll just keep going here. Naturally, I acted out. How do you expect a 6-year-old to respond when he knows his father was sent to jail over a lie? I didn't know about the child support until years later. This made them up the drugs. I went from a quarter tablet to 2 to 2.75 tablets. I understood this back then as them trying to drug the problem away. I was suspended from school 4 times that year. He talks here a little bit more about the birth of his second baby sister, another bully nurse who, fortunately, his stepfather kicked to the curb faster than before, his father's early release from prison for good behavior, and a trip that he and his family take. So the real fun started when we got back from the vacation. The social workers continued their mission to find fault in my father. They tried to attach every bad behavior we exhibited to my father and his discipline practices. I didn't play ball, and my Ritalin dose was increased another full tablet. They couldn't give them to me all at the start of the day, so I had to take half at home, half at school, which got me bullied even more than I was getting before. Thankfully, I had the school janitor, who was the nicest lady in the world, but was also stern. She could see what was happening from a mile away. She made school bearable, along with another male teacher, who could see what was going on. The two of them almost lost their jobs on a couple of different occasions for standing up for me and my eldest brother. Again, something I found out a few years later. So then he just jumps ahead a little bit here in time. 1995. So by the start of the year, halfway through the school year, I was on 5 full tablets of Ritalin per day at the age of 8. Still resisting the evil father mantra of the social workers, still angry about special ed, and my eldest brother had to punch out one of his classmates for bullying me, a kid who was 4 years older than me. My eldest brother had finally gotten sick of the shenanigans of the other teachers at the school and decided to say, fuck it all. It was the first wake-up call the school had to that they might be the root of our problems and not actually us. Their initial reaction was not so good, I'm afraid. The social workers had me put on a different drug, worried that Ritalin was not working. They tried something called Risperidol. Not familiar with that one. This was the beginning of hell for me. It robbed me of 2 things, proper empathy for others and my conscience. I spent more time at home than at school that year. He talks a little bit here about switching to a new school and the more frequent visits with the social worker. He also talks about saving his sister from her bullies and being suspended from it, which helped his stepfather see where some of the problems were and demanding that his medications be reduced. So the problem was, part of it was already too late. More than a few thoughts and feelings had become twisted within me, and the consequences were going to present themselves soon enough. Now he jumps ahead to 1997. Remember that bad brother? Well, he does something that gets him sent to jail. This makes the entire town treat me worse than they already were, believing that I would be the same. They were not entirely wrong. The difference was literally between being drugged and not being drugged. My empathy and conscience had been severely messed with, remember? How do you express love when your brain has been fried by drugs? Oh, right, with sex. I loved my sisters, and I just threw up while writing this more than once. Can you imagine remembering something that you've done once all your brains are back in your head, and you can remember what you've done almost perfectly? Well, that was not the case back then. I don't think I need to go into that part any further. Don't put kids on drugs. Please don't. So I just want to take a bit of a pause here for this one also, just because I think that it's been talked about a lot, honestly, about how kids are overdrugged these days. And the fact that an 8-year-old was put on 8 tablets or 5 tablets of Ritalin per day, it just seems kind of ridiculous to me. Like, I don't know what your thoughts are on this matter, Anna, but I've always been of the opinion that, like, drugging children this young is kind of just like, it's silly. What do you expect young boys to behave like, quite frankly?
Well, I do wonder also what the prescribed dose is and who these people were that were prescribing it, and if that was within their rights, because of course if it wasn't, that could be an actionable offense. On the other hand, I'm not too familiar with research that in any way links aberrant sexual behavior with Ritalin, so I'm not too sure what is happening all there with this letter, to be honest.
Yeah, I'm not sure about that part either. Like, he does talk about being put on a different drug called Risperidol, but I'm not at all familiar with that one, so I really don't know about any possible side effects with that one. But
there's Risperidone, can treat schizophrenia, bipolar disorder, and irritability caused by autism. Can't say I've heard of it, but of course prescription needed. But what kind of drug is it? Sometimes they would just give you anticonvulsants for. Or just SSRIs for schizophrenia. So,
yeah.
Antipsychotic. Yeah, but how does it work?
but yeah, I mean, like, not even necessarily to get into the technical aspects of it. Like, yeah, I've not heard about. Oh, somebody just gave us $10 and said Risperidol, Risperidone is an antipsychotic. So. It is really weird then that they would have kind of swapped from these ADHD drugs to that kind of thing. Like it just seems like a massive leap in logic. And
okay, so it's a that's interesting. It's a dopamine antagonist and a serotonin antagonist. But it is an inverse agonist, 5-HT2A inverse agonist. That is so interesting.
Well, I mean, like the dopamine antagonist, I do know that that is a thing.
Weird mix of things. But also histamine of all the things. But no, it's really weird because it is blocking certain serotonin receptors and dopamine receptors, but then. Inverse agonist seems like also is an antagonist, but it's not, and I'm not really sure what the difference is between those two. Like, Master would know this better, but antagonism is when you, like, completely block off the receptors.
Well, antagonism is when basically you kind of do something that does the opposite of it enters into the receptor and then it kind of produces the opposite effect, whereas the agonist is like the thing that basically blocks the effect, right? That's the way I always understood it.
Well, the way it works more specifically is agonism is activating. It's weird words like agony and agonist, like, what is that? But no, agonism means activating it, so therefore producing the result that is stimulating that production of that neurochemical. So, for instance, cocaine is a dopamine agonist. So when you take cocaine, it agonizes dopamine receptors, and so that causes dopamine release in your brain. And then, of course, you get numb to it and, you know, are unhappy because, like, the brain reacts to that huge release. And that's some of the problems with SSRIs and things like that. But antagonism is the opposite of that. So you block off the receptor and it does not get activated at all whatsoever. So a lot of times SSRIs, it's selective serotonin reuptake inhibitors. So you are blocking, you are inhibiting reuptake, inhibiting availability of serotonin to the brain, which sort of acts like an antagonist. You are providing less serotonin. You are giving, it's like the opposite of agonism. So you get nothing from that whole thing. And of course, the body reacts, the brain reacts to that as well by creating more receptors. It's a weird, interesting homeostasis machine that we've talked briefly and at length throughout the Cherry Stem shows and will many times again, because, you know, it is definitely a complex system to be understood. But on the basic level, agonism is activating it, therefore releasing that particular neurochemical, and antagonism is not releasing it. But inverse agonist is like, what does that mean? Because agonism means activating, but inverse, they're like, what the frick?
I did read about this, but it's been such a long time that I've obviously lost some of it. So, I mean, psychiatry wasn't my focus, but I did take some biological psychology, and I found it very interesting, but clearly I have lost it.
It's one of those things you got to keep a frequent contact with, or to remind yourself of all the things.
exactly.
But yeah, it's just still, though, no data that I'm aware of to connect serotonin and dopamine antagonists to aberrant sexual behavior. So I'm not, yeah, really sure what is exactly the deal there. But I'm open to research, PubMed, or any sort of higher end journal peer reviewed, send them my way if you can.
Yeah, absolutely. Like that would really be, I'd be really interested to read more about that. It is, I mean, obviously not to diminish your experiences or anything.
Let me go ahead and diminish your experience. No, not to diminish your experiences, but part of my brain, because I always have that part as any therapist. I have a, or not licensed, but you know, though it is what I went into school for and practice it daily on cam and in sexual work. As we know, 50% of the time, the John wants to talk to the prostitute. So, you know, in my web client interactions, I definitely practice my craft quite a bit as well. And so, not to diminish your experience, but on the other hand, there's that part of my brain that goes, this sounds like a fucked up torture porn erotic fanfic. So, like, I don't know. I'm torn. On one hand, like, if real life really does mimic fan fiction erotica, that's, like, good, I guess, or bad, because some of that stuff is really fucked up and only is good while it exists in fantasy. So, you know, it really does, it is unfortunate if that really did happen to you, and my heart goes out to you for that. But on the other hand, I am aware of people who say things for effect as well. So it's one of those things where I'm like, I don't know. Sounds like an erotic fanfic, but I'm just being an asshole. So we'll go back to not trivializing your experience.
Right. I'll go ahead and finish this off. But before I do, I don't want to miss the other super chat. So Octavio Bannock gave us 2 more rupees and said, does this include absinthe? And I'm pretty sure he was referring to other medications and things like that. And it's like, well, I suppose if you use absinthe in a certain way, it could possibly be qualified as a medication, but only in the loosest sense of the term. So, getting back to where we were, he skips ahead to 2001 here, and he said, my stepfather and I had a small falling out, so I went to live with my grandmother. She was closer to the high school, so it made good sense at the same time. I was getting sick of taking drugs, so I wanted to know. I wanted to know why I was ADHD and back on Ritalin 4 tablets a day. I found out that the local town library had the university books for 1995 psychology and early neurochemistry. It was after reading through the first year text that I realized I needed to stop taking the drugs. I also told the social workers to shove it. I was suspended only 2 times that year. After reading my way through the second year of psychology and neurochemistry, I told the social workers that I was never coming back to see them. They didn't even try to argue with me. I was suspended on average 2 times a year from this point, from what I understand.
Wait, hold on, I'm sorry. How old is this person at the time of saying this? Because it says still counselors, meaning like school counselors? Is that what we're talking about, or...?
I think we're talking about like just the social workers, like not necessarily connected.
Well, in other words, social workers is one of those things that you have until you're 18, and then after 18, like, they don't really care about you anymore, right? Social workers, from what I understand.
It kind of depends on the social workers, honestly. They're kind of a catch-all. It's kind of a catch-all term. Like, we have social workers that I deal with that work with the elderly, that work with single mothers, that do all kinds of different stuff. So,
oh, okay, because yeah, that would change things, because it's like, he's a social worker that works with, you know, special needs, ADHD. I'm not aware of ADHD group being one of those protected groups. It's usually like just severe autism or cystic fibrosis, or, you know, like other severe disabilities, or elderly, or underage, that you would usually have counselors for, or, I mean, social workers. But it's that would make sense, because otherwise it struck me odd as social workers that, like, are hell-bent on putting a man, multiple men maybe even, in prison, or just going after male authority figures so aggressively, that would be told by a potential child to shove it and not even argue. Like, that just doesn't track. As like, why can a kid tell them to fuck off, I'm not taking your medication, when they've been so, you know, desperate to just keep medicating, while even an adult couldn't really get through to these people. So it just is a little questionable as to what some of the meanings of the words are. Of course, it's, you know, difficult to parse out these things, because, you know, the person's not here for us to talk to directly, or to, you know, defend themselves, or to explain further as to what they mean by some of the verbiage. But for me, it's difficult to understand some parts of this.
Yeah, well, I mean, and I guess, like, he would have been about 14 when this was taking place, so it is tough to say, but I guess it could be getting to the point here where, you know, he's starting to assert himself a little bit, and maybe they just were like, okay, well, we're not gonna be able to force this person for much longer, or something like that. But, yeah, we're almost finished through the letter here, so I'll just go ahead and finish that off, the last little bit. Okay. So I read my way through all of the psychology and neurochemistry text throughout high school. I stopped lowering my grades on purpose that year as well. I realized there was nothing wrong with me and everyone else could fuck off. 2006, when my conscience finally fully returned, it literally dragged all the bad things I had done out. I could barely keep food down for a whole month, as each memory was as or more sickening than the last. I certainly went to a dark place, contemplated suicide and everything. Problem was, I had the tools that I developed from psychology. I brought myself down from suicide without drugs, by hanging out with my father and getting out of my own headspace. Conclusions: I'm going to have to live with the bad things I've done that make me sick even to this day when I think about them. Most of my family and my sisters no longer speak to me, and how could I blame my sisters? And now, as I try to live a good and honest life, I'm told that I'm a monster for trying to live the good and honest life before even approaching whether I had done anything bad or not. I now understand the connections to my misdiagnosis back when I was a child, where it all stemmed from, and why I do resent it with every fiber of my being for what it did to me, and what it looks to continue to do to others. Best of all, since becoming aware of this back in 2010, I've since been passively studying the system and the local kids, watching how the whole thing is unfolding, and it sickens me. I will rail against the system that created me as a monster, and I will go down like Ahab if I have to, but I'm going to take as much of the bullshit with me as I can when it happens. I am C, and I am the one monster the system did not want to create. So, there we go. That's the end of that letter. So, yeah, like, I mean, like, basically, what I think the thing to take away from this letter is, like, even though, like, as we've mentioned, there are some things that maybe bear further scrutiny and exploration. Certainly, I think the thing that we can all take away from it is that immediately jumping to drugging children, in, you know, it's never going to be a good thing to do, in my mind. Like, there are some children that are legitimately going to need it, but it feels like it's gotten harder to kind of detect these children just by virtue of the fact that it's become so ubiquitous now that a lot of people will just assume that normal boy behaviors are indicative of mental problems.
Right, exactly. What's normal and what is also what is caused by distress and the system around them. And that's, you know, essentially the bigger issue is we have a fucked up system that creates things we don't like, and instead of changing the system, we try to medicate those symptoms away.
Yep. Exactly. But either way, that is the end of our letters that we received from people. So I just wanted to thank everybody again for sending the letters that they sent to us. Like it's not easy to put yourself out there like that and to have to kind of send it to us to read out to everybody so that they can kind of share in your experiences.
And you can ignore me being an asshole. I take full responsibility for my my skepticism. It's just how I roll. But of course, that's the difficult thing about things like this. And personal stories are, you know, a person's truth, as we discussed in previous episodes. It becomes amorphous and sometimes and, you know, expansive and not exactly aligned with perhaps what really may have happened, but it is real to that person one way or another. It still causes, you know, perhaps even legitimate distress, and there definitely is clearly something going on. There's clearly not, you know, there's distress in one way or another, whether it is in legitimately having a fucked up experience that you're trying to overcome, or having whatever experiences that caused you the need to, you know, want to be heard and seen in whatever way you can get it. Either way, it is still all comes from a place of need, and I have always profound empathy for any kind of lacking of something, like any kind of pain. Definitely don't take my skepticism for anything callous. I 100% have empathy for people and their pain, and sometimes the necessary thing to recover, as we were talking about it in the mental health episode about psychologists, is that counselors, etc., is that sometimes you do need to walk the hard path of, you know, radical self-acceptance, but also, you know, that also means being radically honest. Actually, I do advocate radical honesty. It is a book I have and still have not read, but I have lived by the radical honesty principles for a while. And sometimes that is a necessary thing to do, to find and get at the root of your problems if you really truly want to overcome your issues. And that's one thing I do feel like we could take away from all the letters. All of them combined, I think, are a great example, shining example, in fact, of people trying their best to have a better life through their own, by their own means, like through their own efforts. Especially is exemplary in this case, in all these cases, in these letters, because you have life throwing everything in the kitchen sink at you, and you're still trying to, you know, make the best of it. And I feel like that is an extremely important voice that needs to be amplified, and it isn't frequently acknowledged. It's usually, you know, we see people either who suffer and buckle under that stress, or people who, you know, everything's perfect for them. We rarely see people who get brought down super low, you know, get kicked down 7 times, but rise 8, you know. So I definitely appreciate that sort of spirit that I think emanated from all the letters.
Yeah, for sure. And I think one thing that I really appreciated too was the range of experiences that people demonstrated, like with mental health. And like even one person even mentioned their positives and negatives with like feminism and feminism in therapy and things like that. And again, it's just a matter of demonstrating how like generalizations are rarely going to lead to like ideal outcomes. Like trying to find people who are legitimately wanting to help you to improve your situation is the most important thing. And
it has to be a case by case basis. So yeah, you can, there are generalities that you can skirt by, but once again, you have to experience, but then again, like that's one thing we talk about on Cherry Sam all the time is what is probability? Probability is based on your experience. So if you have a limited range of experience, if you've only been to, you know, two burger places and they've always sucked, and you're like, all burger places suck. It's like, no, you've only been to two in like a like seafood places, and you're like, you've been to two in a crappy landlocked town in, you know, Iowa. Like, what are you talking about? Of course you're not gonna have good sushi in Iowa. Like, you have to go to multiple places and try. In fact, I think 37% is the optimal number if we consult computer statisticians and in general people who look into optimal procedures. It's I think 37% of the market you have to explore before you get a generally good idea of what is actually out there. So probability of experience is based on your experience, and so if you have probability, therefore if you have expectation, it is based on your probability, and probability is based on experience. And if you've had limited experience, then you're going to have extremely skewed expectation. So if you know, if you only live on a diet of internet memes and haven't actually been outside of your house because you're like, you know, young, for instance, or, you know, whatever else, agoraphobic, I don't know, or work from home, whatever it is, where, you know, you haven't interacted with the normals or just the regular people out there. You haven't actually met face to face with many of them in your vicinity or throughout the world. You're not going to necessarily know what the generalities are because you have a very loud minority in the form of internet or other things where things are funneled and concentrated, and you get to see a particular view of things, but that is a skewed sample. You don't have an actual, real, legitimate experience of the actual, true, legitimate world out there enough to have generalities that are as accurate as they could be. So go out there and explore, and you know, case by case basis of at least 37% before you you make assumptions or generalities. At least do some research. You know.
Mm-hmm. Yep. I think doing research ahead of time on counselors, kind of like I advocated for the last time, is definitely the way to go, because that will do it. Doing your vetting beforehand will allow you to, like I said, find somebody who's best targeted to you and your needs. So, but I think that we've gone ahead and talked everything out here. So again, I just wanted to thank everybody for sending in their letters. Thank all of you so much for listening. Thank you, Anna, for, as always, being a lovely co-host.
Being an asshole.
In more ways than one.
Yeah, you're welcome. You need a token asshole on the show. A token liberal, token asshole, whichever. I'll fill the roles. It's like we're a good cop and a bad cop that way. So it works out.
There we go. All right. But yeah, so I don't know when we'll wind up doing the next one, but, you know, in the meantime, I wish you all the very best of luck in getting through whatever trials and tribulations you are getting through. I love you all, and I hope that you all have a very wonderful night. So, goodbye.